Hi, everyone. Welcome to Rick Rule's Bootcamp on Prospect Generation. My name is Steve Enders, and Rick asked me to talk to you today about prospect generation or the prospect generator. And so today I'm going to talk about the business, the science, and the model and how it works. And I'm going to use examples from the gold and the copper business. And I'm going to talk about it from both the major's perspective, the junior's perspective, and the focus is on what's of value to you as an investor and how you might make good choices for investments in the prospect generator sector. So let's get started. Typically, I'm used to talking or lecturing in front of a live audience where I can ask people things like, so how many of you know about prospect generation and what would be your definition? But today we're pre-recorded and so I can't do that. So I'm assuming that some of you know the prospect generation model very well and others might be curious and not know. So I want to start with what Rick thinks a prospect generator is. And he says it's a prospect generator is an exploration company that uses the management's technical expertise and commercial acumen to generate investment ideas and an investment thesis. They stake or acquire exploration rights to the physical terrain, and then they bring in other partners to share the financial risk in return for carried interest in the property or royalty. I think that's a pretty good definition, but it misses the key piece here that making discoveries is a very high-risk business, and it requires companies to have more than one prospect in their portfolio to have the odds of success be better. So let's go on and see what we're going to talk about today and what we're trying to do. But the first is for me to tell you what my equation is for how this works. It's simply my technical expertise, other people's money, which we call OPM. Both of those are required to make prospect generation successful as a business for both the major companies and the junior companies. So the objectives for the day that Rick gave me is to help you understand what the business of public company prospect generation is all about, and we'll spend quite a bit of time on that, is to make sure that you know that some joint venture partners, which are typically majors or senior companies, are better than others. Some have credentials like in-country experience. Others have specialized exploration or mine-building expertise. And really, a partner that has an exploration pipeline need or a willingness to form a regional strategic alliance over a longer period of time is a really good kind of a partner to have, because they're in this for the long term. And actually, time is an important factor here. We also want to talk about what the generator's process is for partner cultivation and selecting. It's essentially a very critical part of understanding the junior's business plan, and it clearly provides a competitive advantage to how they go forward. So that's what we're up against today. So why me? Well, I've had a lot of experience doing prospect generation, both on the major and the junior side, and in the gold and the copper business. We choose gold and copper because they account for 70% of the Western world's global exploration expenditures. So using them as an example is a great idea. I was head of global exploration for Phelps Dodge before Freeport. I came to Denver to be head of exploration worldwide for them. When I got retired from Newmont at the end of, or in 2009, I joined EMX Royalty Corp, and I became the executive chairman and the chief operating officer, and I'm still a senior advisor for them, and their front end of their business is all prospect generation. I'm also a co-founder and a director of Cooper Canyon Capital, which is a private equity company, more in the drill and build space than prospect generation, and we just sold our flagship property in Botswana about a month ago. And my second career has been as a professor and a department head at the Colorado School of Mines. So I have a lot of perspectives to bring on this particular issue. So what are we going to do? We're going to go over the business of prospect generation. We're going to go over the science, and we're going to go over the model, and then I'm going to wrap things up at the end. So let's talk about the business. Talk about gold and copper both. I said they represented 70% of worldwide exploration expenditures in 2023. And we'll go over their particulars because it's really important. And it also helps us understand what the juniors need, what the seniors and major companies need. We'll talk a little about prospect generation in that whole piece. So let's do that. Some key things about the gold industry. Typically, gold deposits are small with short mine lives, certainly compared to copper or iron ore, as an example. The median size of a gold deposit is only about 350,000 ounces of gold, not very much. But because gold deposits have what we call a log-normal distribution, there are very, very many small deposits and very few large deposits. But the large deposits give us a mean that's much bigger than the median, which is the 50 percentile. So the mean is about 1 to 2 million ounces, which isn't bad, right? A junior would love to find a 1 to 2 million ounce deposit. And a major would say that's a good start. Mine lives are typically 7 to 10 years. There's a lower barrier to entry than other metals. CapEx typically ranges from $250 million to over $1.5 billion. And there's no sophisticated marketing of final product needed in the gold business. You produce gold doré, and you sell it to a refiner. Pretty simple. There's some fundamental challenges. One is it's easy to deplete reserves faster than exploration can replace them in the gold business. Makes it a very fast-paced kind of nail-biting industry. The time frames, longer than we want, but still shorter than copper. From initial exploration to first production in a success case takes 13 years. And I'm always assuming that we can make a discovery in the first 4 years. And discoveries that are material, though, are rare, and they're occasional, certainly from the major's perspective. So the gold industry is a great place for the junior company, whether it's a drill and build company or a prospect generator. Gold is a great place for them to be. We know there's a lot of seniors and senior companies, not necessarily majors, but some majors in the gold business. And they have a constant need for new projects because they're typically small and short lives. So let's go on and talk something about this. We're going to look at this graph twice. This is a cumulative frequency diagram of 5,000 gold deposits that are all bigger than 10,000 ounces. So along the x-axis is the amount of endowment on a particular deposit. And endowment is past production, current reserves and resources measured in millions of ounces. And so the one in the upper right-hand corner represents 1 million ounces. The 10 is 10 million ounces, 100 is 100 million ounces, and so on. I'm most interested in the lower right-hand corner of that cumulative frequency diagram where we start to talk about important numbers. So I cut it off at 1 million ounces. And what this says is that 30% of all known gold deposits are bigger than 1 million ounces, but only 10% are bigger than 4 million ounces. That's just how you read this chart. So what does this mean if I'm going to explore for a gold deposit and I want to find a big one? Well, the chances are if I run an exploration program and it is successful, only 1 in 10 times am I going to find something bigger than 4 million ounces. Not bad, but still not particularly good odds. So I know that the good majors, Barrick, for example, Newmont, are really, really good at exploration and making discoveries and advancing them. I know from a 20-year period with Newmont when I was there and before I was there, their odds of success were 1 in 100 in making a discovery. Now you multiply 1 in 100 times 1 in 10 and you're at 1 in 1,000 odds of making a discovery of 4 million ounces or bigger. Junior companies as a sector are not very efficient at spending their money in the ground because they all need offices, they all need CEOs, they all need CFOs, they all need exploration managers. They have a lot of costs wrapped up in G&A and not all of them are interested in making discoveries. But as a class, let's just say they're 30% effective at spending their money on exploration. So now 1 in 3 times 1 in 100 times 1 in 10 is the odds of 1 in 3,000 that Rick talks about when he says the odds are pretty slim, right? So that's how you get to that point. It's similar in some ways and different in copper. So the copper industry typically has very large deposits with long mine lives. The median is only about 200,000 metric tons of copper in an individual deposit. But because there are some deposit styles that are very, very big, the mean, so the average, is really 3 to 4 million tons of contained copper. And the mean is getting into the range that major companies are interested in and senior companies are interested in investing in. Mine lives are typically 15 to 20 years, some more than 50 years, some more than 100 years, right? There's a high barrier to entry than other metals. The CapEx typically ranges from $1 billion to $4 billion. There's a project in Chile called QB2, big new project down in Chile that was $8 billion. So clearly, there's nothing in the copper space other than something small and high grade that meets the ability of a junior company to advance. So they need partners. Also, sophisticated marketing is required of the final product. And there are very strong market controls on price. The fundamental challenge is it's difficult to deplete reserves faster than exploration can replace them. No, it's not. Actually, the other way around. It's actually much easier to replace reserves faster than they can be depleted. There is long timelines for project development and permitting. And, it's difficult to deplete reserves, correct. Long timelines for project development and permitting. An initial exploration to first production takes about 27 years, again, with 4-year time frame for success. So it's very, very different, right? Very different. Here's how it looks from a field size distribution perspective. This is the same kind of plot, just shown in a different way. So what it says is that the median size, so the 50 percentile of all known copper deposits are about 200,000 tons of contained copper metal. Pretty small. But there's a lot of copper deposits out there, and the devil's always in the details. So you need to think about what that looks like. I have a similar chart for gold deposits, but this one is a good example. It shows you that not all deposit types are the same. So on the right-hand side is the median size for a porphyry copper deposit. By the way, porphyry copper deposits contain both gold and copper, as well as molybdenum. So this is just the copper content. So the median size is 1 million tons of contained copper. Looking at a small deposit like a massive sulfide deposit on the left-hand side, you can see that they're much, much smaller, perhaps more suited to a junior company if they want to become a producer. Where this goes is major companies would love to have an investment in a project that has potential for more than 4 million tons of contained copper or more. And a junior company would be delighted to have a discovery like that. In the copper space, the majors like Glencore and Freeport, for example, and Teck and some of the others, they're going to want to, BHP, for example, Rio Tinto, they're going to want to see something at least 2 million tons of contained copper to as much as 5 to 10 million tons of contained copper, sizably bigger type things. But a junior company would be happy to have a discovery of 1 million tons of copper in a porphyry copper deposit, for example, with the potential to become much bigger, right? So that's the way these tend to be looked at. So with the statistics in mind, let's talk about where we're sitting in the business space from the prospect generator versus the rest of the industry. So this figure and the next one come from Doug Silver's presentation that he gave about a month ago or so. And it's the mineral development process. And so you can see the stage and the activity. So the explorers are involved in general reconnaissance. They do prospecting. They develop targets. They do work that leads to discovery. And they do work that delineates that discovery, all to support the developers who come in and do a scoping study, a PEA, a pre-feasibility study. With success, they do a feasibility study. With more work, they get financing for it. In the end, they develop a mine, and then the producers take over from there, right? The prospect generation part of the business is this part right here. The general reconnaissance, the prospecting, the target generation, enough exploration done at their own cost to show that the prospect is worth another company's money and time to invest in. That's what we're talking about here in the entire mining sequence. Here's another way to look at it. This is another chart from Doug Silver that shows where the prospect generators fit on the whole process, with detail in terms of the type of work that's being done, the type of evaluation objectives that are there. And you can see at this point, there's no other work done. There's nothing to do except identify targets and then start the exploration of those targets. So I want to summarize where we are in the business right now, right? So the most important thing that I can say is that exploration is a probabilistic business. And it's not deterministic, it's probabilistic. And the odds are low for success on any one particular venture or any one particular prospect. So it requires many shots on goal, a need to manage the cost of failure, a need to make good decisions very quickly with incomplete information, and the courage to drill, test, and walk if you don't find what you want, or the courage to drill, test, and drill deeper and more if you do see encouraging results. So in the end, majors and juniors need each other. So with that in mind, how do we start to focus on increasing the odds of success, reducing the cost of failure, and leading to discovery that's of value to both the junior and the senior? So I want to talk about the science behind prospect generation, and I'm going to focus on the greenfield environment, even though it's exactly the same in a brownfield environment, except that you already know there's a high probability of success in a brownfield environment because there's already a copper or gold deposit there. So we're going to go through the statistical and spatial distribution of gold deposits. I want to talk about prospectivity analysis and area selection, because it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And so which haystack do we look in? Which ones are likely to have more than one needle? Which ones are easier to find, right? And then I'm going to talk about the exploration toolbox. How do we then focus in on the area that is likely to contain the needle in the haystack? So we'll talk about the geochemical methods, some geological and geophysical approaches, and ultimately getting to a target that can be drill tested at the stage at which a major or senior would be interested in coming in and investing on a project. Going back to the distribution of gold deposits, this is the statistical approach that I talked about earlier. And again, I just want to point out that there's 5,000 deposits on this database, and I really only want to talk about a subset of those, and I want to show you where they're distributed on the surface of the earth, because that's where we do our exploration. So of that database, there's about 800,000 of those deposits of the 5,000 that are bigger than 100,000 ounces, and they're not all shown, but schematically they're all shown here, or they plot over each other. And so here you can see the underlying colors in the continents is an indication of the kind of geology that's there. So we know the geologic environment within which these gold deposits occur. And so I'll just point some things out. We know that gold and copper deposits occur in and beneath the volcanic environment. So volcanic arcs are very prospective parts of the Earth's crust to explore for gold. The most famous is the Ring of Fire around the Western Cordillera of the Americas and around the eastern margins of the Pacific Rim. And you can see in this particular image in Chile or in Peru, the big magenta dot, and by the way, the size of the dots and the color represent size, the big magenta dot is Yanacocha. When you look at Alaska, you see Pebble and Donlin. When you look in Nevada, you see all the Carlin-type deposits. You can see Cripple Creek in Colorado. You can see Homestake in South Dakota. You can see Pueblo Viejo, which is another volcanic arc in the island of the Dominican Republic. Going to Europe and Eurasia and Far East Russia, that's called the Tethyan volcanic belt or orogenic belt. And that is where that's a geologically old volcanic arc. And so there's a number of deposits that occur in that particular arc. Let's go to South Africa. And you can see a number of large magenta deposits that are down there. And those represent the paleo placer deposits that South Africa is so famous for. These are old, deep, very high grade mines that contain probably 40% of the world's endowment of gold in those deposits. Do we go and explore there? No. Do prospect generators work there? No. It's too hard geopolitically, right? But that's where they occur, and we know the kind of geologic environment they work in. The other deposits, like go to Ontario, Toronto, Canada, Western Australia, for example, West Africa, the northern coast of South America, these are environments where the ore deposits form in a very different type of deposit, which we call an orogenic deposit, that's formed from mountain building processes. And so we know the geologic environments that gold deposits occur in, so we can start to focus where we want to work. That map relates to this one. So these are the various types of gold deposits and where they form and what kind of rocks they form in the Earth's crust. So it's a schematic cross-section from the surface down to about 10 or 15 kilometers below the surface. And on the right is the volcanic environment that shows epithermal vein deposits like Midas in Nevada, for example, Waihee in New Zealand, Fruta del Norte in Ecuador, and then the EH are deposits like Yanacocha. The EA is a deposit like Cripple Creek. You get the sense for what that means. These all form in the volcanic environment, and we know where that is on the Earth's surface, right? The middle diagram is the intrusive environment where magma comes up and forms solid bodies that are mineralized. And so the IP is the porphyry environment. The IS is the skarn environment around it. Carlin type deposits occur adjacent to that in carbonate rocks. That's the SC. The IO would be a deposit like Candelaria, Sossego, Salobo in Brazil, or Olympic Dam is the world's most famous one, to give you an idea for that. The lower left hand corner is the orogenic environment where we have shear zone and vein deposits and iron formation type deposits. These are the ones that occur. Like in Ontario, in Western Australia, in Ghana, for example. This is where they form, but because of the deformation of the Earth's crust over geologic time, these become near surface and they're distributed in the rocks that I showed you on the previous map. Now, here's the deal. What should we explore for? Here's a way to look at it. I want to explore for something that is most frequently occurring. So I would like to explore for the shear zone and vein deposits like we see in Ontario, Western Australia, Ghana, for example, because they're most frequently occurring. I'd much rather look for many needles in a haystack than to look for one or two deposits or needles in another one. So we think about it that way. Number two and number four most common are the volcanic deposits, like the veins and the Yanacocha style deposits. And the one in the middle there is the porphyries. They're very common, actually. But look down to the right. You see down there, there's very few. Like EI represents Cripple Creek, right? There's only 13 of those type of deposits that are bigger than 100,000 ounces known in the database. So it's hard to explore for those. So that's how you look at this, is I'm going to explore for something that's commonly occurring. But that's not the whole story. We have to look at what the gold content is. So now all of a sudden, it's a different distribution. So where did our favorite ore deposit go that is very frequently occurring? Well, it's way down on the right-hand side. And you can see that it's not very big overall in terms of the median size or the mean size of those deposits. So it's only 2.7 million ounces on average for each of those deposit styles. But what's different there is we know that they cluster. So for example, Newmont has a cluster of those deposits in their Ahafo mining business unit, one of which is over 9 million ounces on its own and several others which aggregate to 10 million ounces to get to 20 million ounces. So not bad. We also know that some of them can be quite big. Morontau in Uzbekistan is almost 100 million ounces of gold in one style. So I want to explore for those. On the left-hand side, I'm not going to go to South Africa and explore for those, even though they're fairly numerous and fairly large because of the geopolitical situation. So I'm back to thinking about the volcanic environment and the porphyry environment, which shows you there the IP, the EA, for example. And those are the porphyry deposits. Porphyry deposits are low grade, but very, very large in tonnage and gives you a sense. So Cripple Creek now has moved up in terms of the kind that it is. So we think about these. So my favorite personally is looking at the what we call MSV, the shear zone and vein deposits in an orogenic environment. I'm going to show you an example of that. So how do we do that? We do that using global terrain and regional framework studies. And both junior companies and major companies do this. Major companies do this in a very disciplined approach. Junior companies do it in a way that is that emulates what the senior companies do, but typically over a smaller geographic area or geological area. And it's the identification of the most prospective terrains. So that's a portion of the Earth's crust that has the same geologic character and history, belts inside of there, like a mountain belt range, and the districts, mining districts in the world, where there's more than one mine that clusters in an area. And we identify those terrains, belts, and districts based on discovery potential for significant gold deposits first on a technical basis. The other basis that we look at is geopolitical. So I would love to go to Kansas and explore because it's a wonderful, safe place with great rule of law. They know mining, but they don't have any gold deposits. So without a gold deposit, I'm not going to go there. So I have to take more risk, right? So let's go somewhere else where there is a plethora of copper and gold deposits. Let's go to the DRC or Zambia as an example. Or I've worked in Haiti looking for both gold and copper deposits. Why would we do that when they're more high risk? And that's because the opportunity is better than the risk, the geopolitical risk. So to go work in Haiti, I'm interested in finding another Pueblo Viejo on the Haiti side of the border in the same belt of rocks that hasn't been very well explored. Now, unfortunately, Haiti is a country we no longer can work in. So we basically are out of luck there, but you can see you wouldn't go there for something small and low grade. You want to go there for something very big. So we look at it first on a technical basis. We think about the geopolitical basis, but in the end, what we decide has to first be based on, is there potential, and is the potential big enough to offset the geopolitical risk? It ends up with a ranked and prioritized source of exploration pipeline opportunities where we use a bunch of different criteria, both geologic, like structure, and non-geologic, like gold endowment and exploration maturity, to help rate and rank those terrains. So here's an example. Here's about 20 or 30 prospective orogenic terrains around the world shown in green. And you can see that I've highlighted the West African Shield, particularly Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, and the Guiana Shield in Northern South America, which is Venezuela, Guyana, Suriname, French Guiana, and parts of Northern Brazil. Why am I interested in that? It's because they're the same geologic terrain. So on the right is a map that shows Africa and South America being part of the same continent that has been split by continental drift, plate tectonics. And so the Atlantic Ocean now has separated those two continents, but the rocks are similar. So if we go to Ghana, it is a very well endowed country from a gold perspective. It's very, very well explored. It has a lot of people in it. If I want to look for similar kinds of deposits in South America, I'm going to go over and look at Venezuela, Guyana, and Suriname, for example, and I'm going to look for the same kind of rocks. The difference is it's all covered in rainforest, and exploration maturity is very, very low. So perhaps 10% mature over 90% mature, right? So I'm going to use my logic that says I'm going to explore for shear zone and vein environments in the Guiana Shield because it's similar to what we see in West Africa and hasn't been well explored. But now where do I go once I've decided to go there, right? So we do a regional framework study, which is to say, now that I am in the Guiana Shield in South America, where are the best places? So we take data sets, as many as 140 in this particular example, and we put them together with teams of geologists, or nowadays we can use machine learning, artificial intelligence, where we're looking for the indications of where there might be gold deposits based on, one, we already know their gold deposits are there, so where are similar target areas, or we look at what the requirements are to have a prospect, and we look at the data, and we say, where are the conditions prospective for that? But we end up with a map on the right that's called a prospectivity map. And the goal is to eliminate 85% of the areas not being prospective, leaving 10% or 15% of the terrain where the best opportunity is. And those become the areas we want to do reconnaissance on and see if there's any indication that there's gold or silver there. So how do we do that? Well, we have access to a lot of public data about the geology, sometimes the geochemistry, sometimes the geophysics, that we can use to decide where we want to go in the field. But in the end, we have to go look for gold, or we have to look for indications of copper. This is one of the best things in our geochemical toolbox, to look for the presence of gold in a brand new area where I might want to acquire exploration rights by staking claims or acquiring leases from the government. And what we do is we take sediment samples of the stream sediment, come up with the very finest material, and we leach the gold, the silver, and the copper out of that sediment using cyanide. Why do we do this? It's because the sediment contains the erosional signal of weathering gold and or copper deposits in a drainage basin. We replot the results on a map where we took the sample, and we go out to the field and we physically go look and do reconnaissance and prospecting in the drainage where that sample came from. So in this particular case, which is an example from Suriname, you can see that the better than 8 parts per billion Blegg anomalies all occur on the north side of that topographic high. That is where we're going to want to focus our attention in the field. So now we got our attention of where we might want to be physically. So we also need to have more information. In this particular case, we need to understand the geology. Well, we can't map it because it's covered by rainforest. So we have to use aeromagnetics to understand what the distribution of rocks are. So on the right-hand side of this diagram is an aeromagnetic map interpreted to show geologic units and geologic structure. And you can see by the star, that is a prospect called Nassau, which we had in Suriname. And it was identified by the presence of artisanal miners. They were called pork knockers, was a name, the local name, but they're artisanal miners. So they were mining gold in the nearby drainages. On the left, we wanted to start knowing more about the kind of rocks that were there. And so we conducted airborne electromagnetic surveys that gave us an indication of whether there's magnetic rocks there and whether there are resistive or conductive rocks there. So we start to hone in on something we might want to acquire rights to if we have not already acquired property or exploration rights to it. Now we want to hone in on what might be a target, right? So we've already done the work to decide where in the world we want to go. We want to where in the our favorite terrain we want to go. The fact that there's gold there, we've acquired some rights, we're doing some detailed work. By now, we may or may not have brought in a partner, but we're going to do more work. In this particular case, we're doing what's called an endose polarization resistivity study. And we are looking for rocks that are either resistive or conductive. So gold deposits occur with silica or quartz. Quartz is a highly, highly resistive mineral, and it's easy to identify using electromagnetic methods or induced polarization and resistivity surveys. And in this particular image on the right, it shows a whopping anomaly that was at the Nassau prospect, which is now turned into Newmont's Merian mine that has reserves of 8 million ounces. That's a success case in how we do this. In the end, we end up having to drill. We have to log and acquire the data and build it into one model. And this is clearly the purview of the partners who come in and do the heavy lifting on this and then take it down the track in terms of development that I showed you on the process stages. In the end, we have to leave behind the community better than when we arrived. We sometimes leave water wells for the community, but we're always having to do it in a way that maintains our social license, because we can screw it up from the beginning and it doesn't matter what's there. You won't be able to get a permit or social license to move it forward. So it's a very important aspect. All right, that's the science behind it. So now we've really increased our odds by deciding where we want to work and how we target. Let's talk about the business model, the prospect generator model. So I want to talk about that, the factors that impact company performance, what the essential elements for success are, how do we originate new ideas, how do we bring in partners, and how does this all work? So the model, right, the model, to restate it, you start with early stage prospects, which you get on your own by staking land or acquiring exploration leases from the government, or you can buy them from another company or from an individual prospector. You can do this in the greenfield or the brownfield environment, but it requires a new exploration premise. And an exploration premise is an assertion or a proposition that forms the basis for an exploration program. Anyone that you talk to in exploration needs to be able to tell you why they are doing exploration, what their geologic premise is for doing their program. It's essential. The company then adds value through high quality exploration, and they typically fund the initial exploration work. At some point, they've done enough work to make their prospect attractive enough to another company, where they do a deal in exchange for less equity, right? A stake in the game, maybe a royalty, maybe a joint venture opportunity option. And the partner brings in funding. They bring in expertise. They may or may not bring in jurisdictional experience, but if they do that, it's helpful. And the most important thing is they bring in the ability to advance a discovery. The company then builds a portfolio of these interests that somebody else is funding, and they use the money to reinvest in the prospect generation model, and they build a portfolio. So as an investor, you need to be concerned about a prospect generator that has a small portfolio, because the odds of success aren't there. You want a company that has a large portfolio that's funded by high quality partners. If you have an opportunity to invest in an exploration company, a junior exploration company that has only one or two or three key properties, they're in a bit of a different business than prospect generation. They're assuming, or how about this, hoping that those one, two, or three projects are going to be successful. So they better be much more advanced prospects than just a great idea that they want to do some work on. So some factors that impact company performance: access to capital for funding. Absolutely essential, and that's why partners are there. You have to have a high quality of exploration properties, or at least a perception that the potential is there and it can be identified based on the work program that's being proposed. You have to look at the stage of the projects. Are they grassroots, where there's no evidence at all, just a great idea, or whether there's already a discovery made or perhaps some prospects that have been mined in the past? Where are you along that continuum of discovery to development? And the companies have to have matching goals. The project has to be consistent with the goals of the company. There has to be good technical merit and ranking of those opportunities relative to others. So for example, a partner company might come in and they might say, we already have a portfolio of gold properties that look like this. Why is this better? So the junior company should be able to say, this is better because of these reasons. So it becomes compelling. Or one of the reasons might be company XYZ wants to invest in a new country that's just opening up for exploration, and the junior is there. And one of it might be, well, technically this is a good project, but it's in an area of the world that you want to be in. So you have to have an explanation for it. And obviously the location and geopolitical jurisdiction makes a difference in terms of the company's performance. Sovereign rents, taxes, safety, government, the legal system, these are all important factors. Another one is social license to operate. You have to have community and government support and approval. And you have to operate your business, conduct your field programs in a sustainable way, which means that the first exploration geo on the ground acts appropriately in the local community and starts to learn upfront what the community is about, what they like, who are the decision makers, and they need to tell people what they're doing. There are some exploration companies that try to work under the radar, which means they say, well, we're just trying to do our thing. And when we make a discovery, we'll tell people about it. They're already too late. It's already too late. You have to start your community engagement with the first boots on the ground. Looking at a investment in a company that's a prospect generator, or one that's more along the drill and build model, you have to look at their sustainability values, if you will. You have to look at their track record of environment, social, government, community relations. If it's not good, I would say you want to run. Don't walk away from that opportunity, because it doesn't matter how successful their program will be technically, they will never get a permit and you will never get a partner for it. You also have to look at people and productivity. So the exploration team has to be technically competent and the management team has to be commercially competent. And in the end, there has to be reality checks. So you have to know where you are in the business cycle, and you have to understand what the availability and sources of funding are and what their expectations are in terms of how you're going to use that money. And in the end, you have to pay attention to the probabilities of success, and you have to make decisions based on incomplete information. And that's both the explorer as well as the investor. So, essential elements for success: 3 P's. The company that you want to invest in, you need to understand who the people are. There's the visionary behind it, the person who plans the work, the person who executes the program. But in general, you have to look at the management and sometimes the boards, especially if there's executive management, executive board members. You have to look at their track record of success, which I would argue needs to be something obvious within the first 10 years of their career in the business. So if someone comes to you and they're a 30-year veteran and they've never had exploration success that they can point to that they were directly involved in, I'm not sure I'd make the investment. But you might find someone who's 8 years out where they've had great success. They've worked on projects that were successful. They've worked with companies where they had an exploration management role in a smaller company where they've made a discovery. That's the kind of people you want to think about. You also have to look at what the value of the projects, or we call them the assets, that the asset base is, the project or the property. What's its current value in the market? And what the potential is in a success case. And there has to be an exploration plan that goes with it, a program, a budget, a schedule, a funding that's logical and makes sense. Those are the three P's. If the CEO that you talk to or the presentation that you look at online when you're doing due diligence on an investment doesn't talk about people, project, and plan, run, don't walk away from that opportunity. But there's something really important here as well. I call it the fourth P, and that's the premise. That is the geological and exploration proposition or statement that says, here's why we're doing this. And they need to be able to tell you what success looks like at each stage of work. If they can't quantify that, then I wonder if they've really done enough thought into how they're thinking about their exploration program. And the answer can't be, well, we're looking to hit an ore grade interceptor over a mineable thickness. That's not an answer for me. What I'm looking for is, I have this geological information. It correlates with this geochemical anomaly. I have geophysical indications that there's mineralization or alteration present. It looks to be this big. What I'm trying to do is figure out if it's present or absence, or if it's bigger than what I said it is. That makes more sense. So what is their premise? Other considerations are location, access, mining code, political regime, culture, language, safety, community, workforce issues. These are all important, but they're more about the individual project itself at that point, not so much about the management. Okay, so where do new ideas originate? In major and senior companies, they typically take a very, very disciplined approach to generative exploration and have generative exploration teams that do terrain studies, they do regional framework studies, they do their own prospect generation, they do deals with juniors, they do deals with prospectors, they have a business development component that's focused on coming up with the next new thing, right? Mid-tier companies don't do prospect generation at all. You rarely see them as partners in a junior prospect generator company. And that's because they're too busy developing or operating their own projects and their own mines. Where do juniors get their new ideas? Well, a lot of them come from the majors and the seniors. So they have what I call vest pocket ideas from their work with the majors and juniors, perhaps a project that they couldn't get a budget for, or the project was terminated for some reason other than the fact that it was prospective. And so their former employer never did anything with it and the project is available. Those are wonderful ways to generate opportunities. There are other ways to do that. And that is with your network of contacts locally. So if you're working in Colorado, who's doing exploration in Colorado, which is where I'm from, or who's doing exploration in Botswana, where I worked, regionally, who's doing work in South America, right? Or in the Guiana Shield in Suriname and Venezuela and Guyana, right? And then the best place is professionally. Who do you know out there? And what is your reputation and what is their reputation? Don't mistake that for not having a disciplined approach. There are a number of junior companies that have a disciplined approach, not unlike the majors, but on a smaller scale. The other thing is junior companies typically are early movers in new jurisdictions and with new geological concepts because they're smaller. They can make decisions quicker. They can get after it. And so there's a great symbiotic relationship between the major and seniors and the junior companies, and that they can be a pipeline to new opportunities, and the junior companies can be more nimble, and the senior and the majors can look at what they've found and think carefully about what they want to invest in. Okay, so the business of partnering, all companies do business development. The exploration geos on the project do business development because they pay attention to what's going on in their neighborhood, all the way to the CEO suite, the C-suite, that are looking at opportunities. So business development is essential. Doesn't matter whether you're a junior company or a senior or major company. It's essential. The network of contacts locally, regionally, professionally, critical. News feeds, conferences, reputation, marketing, all places to identify partners, right? Partners. Let's talk about what majors and juniors' expectations are of each other. The major's expectations is that the junior company is serious about discovery and they know how to operate. They're not just there to pump and dump, right? They're not just there to get a property, raise some money on it, blow a lot of smoke, and then sell out, right? They're serious about discovery. And by the way, Rick Rule once told me that only 20% of junior companies are serious about this. So there's a lot of companies you need to say no to. They need to be technically excellent, commercially competent, and ethically sound. What are the junior's expectations of the partner company? Well, they want to know that the partner wants exposure to discovery and to advance the project. They want the partner to bring in funding. They want to have their technical expertise, and they want to know that they have an ability to eventually take over the project. In the end, strong partners help build the junior's reputation, which is why you will see a lot of junior companies, particularly prospect generators, show on a slide who their partners are and brag about them. So, how an exploration portfolio works? Here's an example. There are 44 projects listed along the bottom here, and they rank from more later stage prospects to more early stage projects going from left to right. On the y-axis is the cumulative ounces contributed in a success case by each of those projects, and it's been risked. So for example, a project that has a drill hole with an ore grade intercept over a mineable thickness will have a higher probability of success and higher amount of risked ounces than one that doesn't, as an example. So at the start of the year, let's just say we have $50 million to spend on these 44 projects, where the expected outcome is that at the end of the year, I'll have discovered 3 million ounces of potential resource, right? But when I run my program, it doesn't work that way. Very few of the projects actually give me all the results. And sometimes we can't predict which one it is. But we do know that the projects that don't get into our portfolio have an extremely low probability of success because it is either technically or financially or jurisdictionally. So in this particular case, the new discoveries are shown in terms of the amount of risk ounces they contributed to this pipeline over the course of the year. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them shown here, 2 being very significant. There are potential new discoveries. There's 2 of them in the red dots. There's some with promising results in green. Drilling didn't happen on 8 of them. 2 were sold and 3 were dropped. That's just how the portfolio works. So if you have a small portfolio, what are the chances that your prospect generator is going to be successful? That's why numbers count. Portfolios work. Just as in normal investment, investing in a portfolio of companies works, you can do the same thing. You can invest in a prospect generator that has a portfolio of companies, and you can also invest in a portfolio of prospect generators in your own portfolio, because you've got to be able to manage the risk. So the wrap here is that prospect generation has been going on for millennia. So for centuries, the prospect generator looked a lot like the guy on the left, the prospector who was just out there looking for surficial evidence that there's gold and copper in the rocks at the surface, right? He has a gold pan. He wants to see visible gold. The approach to prospect generation wasn't much different. He was grubstaked, as they called it, by someone who wanted a stake in his game if he was successful. He wanted funding. The image on the right is of more of a modern day prospector. He doesn't look too dissimilar. He has a rock hammer in his hand, not a pickaxe. He probably has a pickup truck, not a burro. Inside of his pack, he has a GPS, he has a cell phone, he has a tablet, he has an XRF. He has all of that that he needs with him. Where are we going now? We're in the third millennium. So we can use today machine learning. We can use artificial intelligence to help us do a better job in terms of coming up with targets. But we still require companies to do something with those targets, which means you have to explore them, you have to drill them, you have to develop and delineate the success cases, and it requires funding from someone besides the junior company. So here's my last slide. This is the final wrap. Exploration is a probabilistic business. It requires many shots on goal. It's needed to increase the probabilities of success, and it's essential to manage the cost of failure. That's the value of a portfolio. Prospect generation is required for new discoveries, right? It just required. Everything starts with a new discovery, whether it be in the greenfield environment or the brownfield environment. The prospect generator business model spreads that risk, right? The juniors get a free ride, so to speak, for their initial exploration investment. The majors and seniors get access to potentially material discoveries. Investors, like you all, need to be savvy about which companies to choose to invest in. You have to look at their track record of success as a company and a track record of success as individuals, be they management, the exploration vice president, the chairman of the board, the CEO. They have to be ethical, they have to have a good reputation, and their team has to be technically excellent. They have to have good prospects and projects. They have to have low general and administrative costs, and they have to be commercially sound. Commercially sound means they're not going to dilute their shareholders by serially raising money at lower and lower share prices, right? And diluting their investors out, as an example. In the end, here's the key for you. Your partners, the partners that are invested in these prospect generators, are doing the due diligence for you. So look for companies that have good partners, good prospects, and management and a board that has a great track record of success. The major companies do this before they invest in these projects. So look at all of those factors when it comes to making your own investments. And I think you will be well rewarded. And I guess to have my final shot, the most important answer you can give to anyone is no, I don't think so. Because almost always you will be right. It's doing the due diligence, as I outline here, to identify those that are successful. So Rick will tell you that he's had 20 investments be successful in a portfolio of investments that he's done over his career of 65. That's 1 in 3. His success is financially successful. So it's a much higher rate of success to be financially successful to make money on investment. The numbers that I provided you in terms of probabilities of success, the long shots are because I'm interested as a miner in advancing a discovery all the way to production. And the odds of that are much, much lower than the odds of actually making money on the investment in a company. So good luck to you. I hope this has been helpful. Thank you.